Good morning and welcome to Friendly Neighborhood Libertarian. I'm your host, Isidore, and today we have Stephen Hicks, a professor of philosophy and author of the book Explaining Postmodernism, Skepticism and Socialism from Rousseau to Foucault. Good morning, Professor Hicks. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Isidore. Thanks for the invitation.
My pleasure. So you seem to think that like postmodernism has taken root in universities. Why do you think it's taken root, and what's so pernicious about it?
Well, I think taken root, certainly, that metaphor means that it's ensconced and pretty fundamental. So if we ask, you know, what's the roots of universities, it's going to be the fundamental ideas that are debated and shared, and postmodernism has become a prominent contender. It's not to say that it's swept the field. There are still lots of modernists and pre-moderns and so on, but it is the new kid on the block, and it's growing fast. Now, why do I think it's pernicious? Well, because to use philosophical labels, we can know the world, but philosophy, or sort of postmodernism, says we can't know the world. Philosophically, I think we are individuals who are largely autonomous with respect to character formation and choosing the course of our lives. And postmodernism denies that, seeing us as members of collectivities that are shaped by forces beyond our control. As a self-realization egoist and classically liberal / libertarian person, I think that we can work out win-win social relationships, and we've made great strides in improving so many facets in human lives. But the postmodernists are fundamentally advocates of oppression and victimization models and adversarial models of human relations, and they take a deeply jaded and cynical understanding of what society has evolved into. So on all those fundamentals, I think postmodernism is wrong, and not only wrong, but dangerous.
So, like, but isn't there some truth to some of the claims that, like, linguistic codes, for instance, are limited avenues for expressing the truth, and that, like, the community that we're a part of really shapes our understanding of things? Mm-hmm. Or do you think that's an independent observation that they've largely, like, parroted?
Okay. Well, if you want to argue that it's true, that language is a real phenomenon and that it works a certain way, then already you are outside of the postmodern framework, because at least fundamental postmodernism says truth is one of those things that we cannot understand. There is no such thing as objectivity. So you would then have to be making claims about language on an objective framework, and that's already not postmodernist. But suppose you don't go a kind of a meta postmodernist direction there, and you just say, is it not true that language is limited? And that's the first adjective that you use there. I would think, no, absolutely, language is limited, but that's not a postmodern argument. Everybody recognizes that language is limited, that our minds are limited, our modes of cognition, our senses, our conceptual faculties, they can be powerful, but of course they do have limits. And an important part of the power of language comes precisely from its limitation. So one way of then saying, what does a word mean? And then we are saying, well, it means these things. It's limited to picking out these things in reality. Or I am going to define a concept a certain way, that is to say, I'm delimiting it in a certain way. And so if the concept is going to be meaningful, it has to have limitations. So that's not, I think, a controversial claim. What the postmodernists do, though, is they will take the limitations of consciousness, in effect, all of the features of consciousness, and rather than saying this is how consciousness works within this set of limitations, they will take the limitations as defeating the possibility of consciousness working. So for example, to use the limited phrase, they will then say, well, consciousness is limited, language is limited, and then they will jump to the conclusion, therefore, Language is not objective capturing of the way reality really is. Now, if you make that move, then there's an implicit premise that's built into your statement. You're saying, since it's limited, it can't be objective or it can't know. But your assumption there is that only an unlimited consciousness could come to know, or only some sort of infinite mind would be then capable of grasping the truth. And already then you say, well, why then are you, this is a bit unfair, but why are you smuggling in this idea a priori that only some sort of infinite, unlimited being could have objective knowledge? And that's actually the controversial premise. And most of the postmoderns explicitly or implicitly smuggle in a concept like that. So what I would say in response to that, though, is to say, no, that's not the right way to do it. We're human beings. That is to say, we are beings that have a certain kind of physique. We have a certain kind of brain. We have a certain mind, a kind of mind or consciousness that emerges right from that phenomenon. But we are in a world where things have a certain identity. They have certain limitations. They work a certain way. So of course, our consciousnesses work a certain way and they have certain limitations. And that's what we're trying to understand rather than saying, oh, there are limitations, therefore knowledge is impossible.
Yeah. But I guess something I'm like a little curious about though, is when you talk about objective as like a fundamentally limited concept, how do we go about describing something like aesthetics? I'm really curious about it. Like, I don't know what's good art or bad art. And it seems like the idea of what is good and bad within art seems to shift.
Yeah. That's a fascinating right application. So if we take the concept of objectivity and we say, well, when we're trying to describe the world objectively, and we say that something like science as a mature working out of objective methods of coming to understand reality, already that's very difficult to work out what objectivity means in science. When we turn to normative issues, it becomes increasingly complicated. What's normatively good and bad, right and wrong? And then it's not just describing the world, but it's also describing us and our value orientation to the world. And then when we turn to aesthetic values and aesthetic responses, I think it becomes even more complicated and controversial as well. So, and here one of the things I would say is that it's not only an issue of philosophical objectivity and working that out and all of the complexities, but that art is a largely psychological process. And psychology, I think, is still in its infancy. So it's, you know, perhaps one century and a bit that the psychologists have said we can now study the human mind or study human consciousness objectively as a social science or as a science as well. So I think we are still in the beginnings of a well-worked out understanding of human psychology. And until we get a richer psychology, aesthetics is still going to be in its infancy. But what we would say is in general terms like this, that art does, I think, serve a function. So I have a functionalist understanding of consciousness, a functionalist understanding of values. And I think art, because of the nature of our complicated psyche, does serve a functional role. Now, I don't know how much time we want to spend on this topic, but if you would say, art, why do we respond to art? And then we typically give three kinds of answers. They are related. We like art for its sensuous appeal, right? I like to look at the colors. I like to hear those sounds. I like to see those shapes. And so much of our aesthetic vocabulary is tied to our perceptual capacity. And so we like to use our perceptual capacity. And part of it then is by analogy to say exercise physically. So we might say, I'm doing an exercise routine. I'm doing some aerobics or I'm doing gymnastics. And it's not that it's actually, you know, making me richer in any direct sense. I'm just using my body in a certain way. But there are pleasures to using my body in a certain way. And the same thing, I think, holds at the perceptual level. Our perceptual capacities are important psychological function to us. And just exercising our perceptual capacities, even in a non-directly functional way, is a source of pleasure to us. Now, the other thing that we say about art is that art stimulates ideas. Right? You know, we like to look at a painting or a sculpture and think about it. You know, what is the artist trying to say? What is he trying to express? What thoughts does it bring to my mind, and so on. And in many cases, the great art is about important themes, important ideas. And you know, when we read a book of fiction, we often have a great amount of pleasure trying to figure out what the themes are, and we recognize that it's important themes, the great works of literature. That then is to say, what art is doing is tapping into our conceptual and rational faculty and giving us deep food for thought. Now here, I think one of the important values of art is that we are a highly abstract species. We think about, you know, the past, the present, and the future. We think about mathematics and all of these big abstractions. We think about our lives as a whole and what they are going to be for the future and all of society. And that is very abstract and hard to get our minds wrapped around. One of the things that art does that helps us cognitively is gives us kind of particular characters and exemplars to work that out in terms of. So it takes something that's very abstract and condenses it. So, I think when I was a teenager, for example, and I might say things like, I want to be James Bond. And so I saw a movie, and I'm inspired by that movie. And I'm a teenager, and I'm somewhat articulate still about what I want my life to be, but I know in some abstract sense, I want it to, to see the whole world. I want it to be adventure. I want to think of myself as competent, and I want to be attractive to women and this, that, and the other things. But all of that is very abstract and inchoate. But what a James Bond type character does is takes all of that and concretizes it. And then I can say, yes, that's what I want to be. So that's another cognitive function that art is surprising, right? Or I don't want to be a certain kind of villain. That person is repulsive, but then I think about what that villain is and what makes that person so bad and disgusting to me. And then the moral principle becomes articulated in my mind more clearly. Now, the other thing I think, so that's to talk about perceptual appeal of art and the conceptual appeal of art is the emotional reactions. So as human beings, we have an extraordinarily complicated emotional range that is possible to us. And there is a pleasure just in exercising all of those emotions in an artistic setting where it's not actual rubber meeting the roads. It is fictional or imaginary, but nonetheless, it's kind of like aerobics for your emotions or doing gymnastics for your emotions. And there's a pleasure to doing that. And I think the best art is the art that is both a perceptual appeal and a conceptual appeal and an emotional appeal. And the point is that all of those need to be worked out philosophically and psychologically until we have a mature theory of art. And until we get there, it's just going to seem bewildering and arbitrary. Now, one more thing I would say is, about art that it's still going to operate at a high level of generality. And one of the important things is that we are still all individuals, right, who are unique. So even if we can work out, good art presses these perceptual buttons and these cognitive buttons and these emotional buttons, that's still going to be at a fairly general range of abstraction with lots of space for individual variation. It'll be something like, as a nutrition scientist, we can work out in general principles. Here's good nutrition. You need proteins and carbohydrates and fats and so on. But that's not going to tell you whether you like Japanese food or Italian food. You can customize those to your individual taste. So that's some very complicated territory, but fascinating.
Yeah. So I'm thinking a lot about that in terms of art that I've seen growing up. Like, you've probably seen The Karate Kid, right?
Yes.
And Cobra Kai, maybe, or some of it?
Well, the first episode and a half, maybe, of the sequel.
Yeah. So it seems like a lot of art has this ability to sort of be relatable in different ways throughout our lives. Is there something suspicious or wrong about our cultural debates about recontextualizing information? In your work, you mentioned Ahab and the whale as being debated between being like technology dominating nature versus something else. Could it be that this is just the problems of our era?
I see. So that then would be a question about great literature. And one of the things that we say makes great literature great is that it transcends its particular times and it speaks universally to all human beings across the ages and so on. And then a pushback question is whether that really is possible. Can we, being rooted in a particular context, transcend our culture and so forth, or not? And then something like Moby Dick and how properly to interpret the theme of Moby Dick would be a working example. Now, the concept in the middle of your question there was recontextualizing, and I think that's the one that would need to be unpacked. So to recontextualize means different things epistemologically, depending on whether you are a small o objectivist or you are a skeptic and subjectivist, say, about language. So to recontextualize initially would be to say, go back to your point about limitations. Initially, our cognitive orientation to the world is from a particular position. And so I have a certain perspective on whatever it is that I'm looking at and thinking about, and I have a limited amount of information about that. Now, one of the things that we learn is that we have a limited amount of information. So before I make too big a claim about whatever it is I'm talking about, I should make a point of gathering more information. And here we start to use metaphors like putting yourself in the other person's shoes, right? Or trying a different pair of spectacles when you are viewing things. Now, the idea here, though, is if you are a small o objectivist, is that your cognitive faculties are in contact with the world, and you are doing more data gathering about the world from different perspectives. And in perhaps a social context, you would recognize that other people have interacted in the world, but from different contexts. And so you need to take those into account before forming your big general principles and offer. So recontextualizing as a cognitive exercise is very important. You put your ideas and your hypotheses to the test, and you let them be challenged from as many contexts as possible, with the idea of that putting you in a better position to grasp a fuller, more objective truth. But sometimes recontextualizing is used from a subjectivist framework. The idea here is that we are kind of trapped inside our heads, or we have this linguistic framework that has been put upon us, and that has shaped my thinking. But that linguistic framework brings assumptions about the way the world is and about what the values are, and that different language groups have different linguistic situations, and that it's very difficult or impossible to think across these linguistic frameworks. So what you're then left with is, I have my linguistic context and the way that I'm always going to interpret certain things about the world, and someone is coming from a very different social linguistic context, they're always going to be taking their linguistic framework and looking at the world from that context, but there's no way that we can communicate with each other. What that then means is that when we turn to a piece of literature, Moby Dick, Homer's Iliad, right, or whatever, we think from this subjective perspective that people are in dramatically different linguistic contexts, and there's no way to say which of those linguistic contexts is any better than the other, because neither of them has any access to the world. We're trapped inside that linguistic framework. So someone who has a different interpretation of Moby Dick from mine, that's just the way it is, and we can't say that any context is any better, so any interpretation is any better, so any interpretation goes. And so if I want to say whatever about Moby Dick, that's perfectly fine.
Can I push back on that a little bit?
Absolutely.
I'm thinking about like Shakespeare in the Bush, talking about like bringing the work of, I think it was Hamlet, to people in Africa, which have a lot more communal societies, and them viewing some of like the or the very informative or very not controversial, but poignant parts of the play they tended to see as different. Like an example was when Hamlet's mom married Hamlet's uncle, they saw that as like a form of honor. I mean, is there like an in-between point between an objectivist approach and like a skeptic point of view that realizes that like different societies sort of place different values on these things, even if they are somewhat linked?
So I'm not familiar with that particular play or performance or show that you're talking about, Shakespeare in the Jungle, but let's just abstract the example that you're talking about. So in some cultures, we would say it is frowned upon for a widow to marry her husband's brother, right? And so in Hamlet's case, he's offended by that. And it's not just that it's his uncle, it's the timing of it, the fast, and he's got other suspicions about foul play that are going on. But just to take that issue, is it appropriate for a woman to marry her dead husband's brother? And some societies are going to say no, and some societies are going to say yes. And some will say it's tolerable, and some will say that it's actually a matter of honor or a matter of moral responsibility for the dead husband's brother to look after his brother's widow, and so on. So we have a wide variation of cultural responses. Now, the first thing I would say is it a fact that these different cultures have these different valuations placed upon that same sort of relationship? So are you saying that that is true, that it is objectively true that there is cultural variability in the evaluation on that? And so it seems that on that score, you would be saying you are an objectivist. Am I fair in making that assumption? Small o objectivist.
Yeah,
it is a fact. Yeah, okay. All right, so we are within a framework, right, of objectivity about the facts of the matter. Now, then the follow-up question is going to be, can we say that one of these positions is the true position about marital relations, and that all people in all cultures should have the same view about marital relations? And there I would say, that objectivity is not the same thing as universality, and objectivity is going to leave a certain amount of wiggle room. So we might be able then to say, well, what is the purpose of marriage? And if we say marriage is already a complicated thing to serve a certain number of values, sexual values, romantic values, friendship values, economic values, security values, and so on, we would then have to take marriage and break it down to a large number of sub-values and then talk about the value of each of those. But then we're at a very high level of abstraction. So again, I'm going to go back to the nutritional example. I'm quite fine with saying, you know, everybody objectively and universally needs to have a certain amount of protein in their diet. But whether you get that protein from beef, from beans, from chicken, from fish, there's a lot of individual and cultural variation that's possible there. And as long as you're within the same universal objective framework of getting your protein necessities, there's a lot of variation at the individual and cultural level that's perfectly compatible with objectivity. And I would say the same thing about marriage. So in the case of marriage, if marriage is to serve, say, just one value, a companionship value, then I would ask, is it possible for a woman and a man to get companionship value from the marriage, even if the man was the brother of a recently deceased other man. And I'm saying, yeah, sure, I'm open to that. So that's not the level of abstraction at which we need to be universal, in which we might say, no, it's perfectly possible for people to get legitimate values in the marriage despite that family relation. And it's also possible for people to get companionship values from not marrying a person who's related to them that way. So that's up to individual variation.
Very interesting. I think I'm getting what you're explaining. Okay. I want to ask you another question that's kind of in a different direction. You make a claim that postmodernists are almost always on the left and on the side of collectivists. Aren't some people like Camus, Baudrillard, Thad Russell, even Deirdre McCloskey examples that sort of at least challenge that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Yeah. So there, that's one of the controversial parts of my thesis. Now, partly this is a philosophical issue, and partly this is a historical evolution issue. So the point that I make in my book is that as a matter of intellectual historical fact, the package of ideas that we call postmodern ideas came into existence in the late 50s on through the early 70s. That's the formative time for postmodernism. And all of the leading postmodernists of that generation are individuals on the left and pretty much of the very far left. So I think as an intellectual historical thesis, postmodernism is wedded to the left. Now then, as a philosophical thesis, if you say, well, what postmodernism amounts to is a kind of epistemological skepticism that's thoroughgoing across all issues. And you ask a follow-up question, does postmodernism have to be associated with any particular political ideology or part of the spectrum? Then I say as a philosophical point, no, it does not have to be so. And so just on that issue of epistemological skepticism, you have found in the now generation and a half or two since the generation of Foucault and Derrida and Rorty, the first generation postmoderns, people from other parts of the philosophical and political spectrum using a hardcore epistemological skepticism to marry it with their politics. Is it the case that if you take postmodernism to be not just an epistemological skepticism, but this idea of group identity and human beings being socially constructed in all of their values. Again, as a historical thesis, intellectually, that became part of the postmodern package in the 1960s and 1970s. But again, if you just abstract that thesis, do you have to be a far leftist to believe that people are socially constructed? Then the answer is going to be no. So then you might take that thesis and combine it with various other political perspectives as well. So the point then is going to be that postmodernism is a philosophical system, but what that means is there are about 10 or 15 or 20, depending on how you count, important philosophical issues in metaphysics, epistemology, values, and so on, that you need to take a position on. And postmodernism in the robust sense is an integrated package of 15 or so. And so what you will expect, though, is that some people will say, I just want to take these ones out and repackage it with something else, or I want to take this one out and repackage it with something else. So there's going to be attempts at repackaging. And so you'll have mixtures of postmodernism with all sorts of other things. So yeah, so individuals, and I know that Deirdre McCloskey has sometimes called herself a postmodern Episcopalian or a postmodern Anglican, right, of some sort. So what she's saying there is that she wants to have some sort of generic kind of middle to high church understanding of Christian theism, and to package that with some of the elements of postmodernism, and mostly it's the epistemological issue. It's a kind of a modified skepticism, and it's a more modest skepticism that she argues for. Or someone like Thaddeus Russell, whom I debated last year on exactly this topic in New York at the Soho Forum. So you can, that was a very interesting exchange. It's online. Who wants to then take, and in his case, it's mostly hardcore epistemological skepticism and subjectivism, but combine that with a libertarian politics. And so that's going to happen, of course, that always happens. But the question then is going to be, are those integrations and repackagings consistent or not? And my then philosophical argument would be that those amount to unstable mixes. There are internal contradictions that when you play them out, you're going to reach a point where you either have to reject the postmodern element in order, say, to retain your Episcopalianism, right? Or you're going to have to reject the postmodern element in order to retain your libertarianism, or you're going to have to say, no, the postmoderns really are right. And if you adopt our premises in these areas, you can't be an Episcopalian or you can't be a libertarian.
I'm a little confused about that, though. I'm thinking about the Marginal Revolution and Karl Menger. And basically the response to the Marxists was that like value is subjective and stuff. Wouldn't some individualism like be part of postmodernist history to some degree? Mm. I'm basically pushing back on your like package of postmodern thought. It seems like a lot of like economic history, at least, has the more postmodern elements to it, responding to modernist collectivism. Is that like a weird contradiction, or how does that work?
Now, I think you are using subjectivism in two different senses. The way that subjectivity is used in the economics literature, and especially in the Austrian economics literature, is not what the postmoderns mean by subjectivity. So let me give you an example. So so someone like Menger, right, comes along and says, the Marxist understanding of value is wrong, because it's a kind of intrinsicism. So what it wants to say is, I mix my labor with something, this is the Marxist account now, and my labor adds value to the resulting product. And so that value now inheres in the product as a property of it. And so anybody who wants to bid up or bid down the price of that embodied labor is doing an injustice, right, of some sort. And what the Menger point is going to be is to say, well, that leaves out the consumer, right, of the product, right, so to speak. So it's not that the value of labor that's been added to the product is now an intrinsic or objective property of it, but rather it requires the evaluation of the product by the end user, right, or the consumer. That's where the value is. So it stops being intrinsic to the object and rather depends on a subject making an evaluation. Now that is fine as long as you keep the language clear. What you are saying though is that the subject is evaluating an object, right, or a service, right, or a project, and a product rather, and that the value is still a relational product. This individual evaluating this product that's out there in the world. Now, that's fine. And if you want to use subjectivity in that sense, I don't have a problem with that. But that's not what the postmoderns or what the philosophers mean when they say that values are subjective. What they will say is that the valuation is totally a product of the subject and has nothing to do with the objective world. So that rather than saying I am able to look at the world and that there are certain universal or objective properties about the world, certain facts about the world that my evaluation is based on, what the subjectivists say philosophically is reality has no input. Right? I am trapped inside my head. It's I have these emotions, for example, is one version of subjectivism. And my emotions have nothing to do with the way the world is. And instead, my evaluation is a making or an imposition on the world of valuation. So it's two different senses of subjectivity. Now, I know this is a long conversation, and every time philosophers and economists get together at conferences, it seems like we spend half the time just talking about what words mean because we have these incompatible or very different uses of core concepts like subjectivity. So once that linguistic confusion is gotten past, I think things clear up. So let me just give you an example. If you talk to an Austrian economist, right, and they say, you know, take a example I sometimes think of is a hard drive. So what we might say is here's a hard drive that some computer company has just put out, and it's a 1 terabyte hard drive or whatever. What the Austrian economists are very interested in is saying, you, Isidore Duncan, how much would you pay for that 1 terabyte hard drive? And you might then say, well, I think about it, blah, blah, blah. I will pay $100 for it. And I then might say, well, I also need a 1 terabyte hard drive, but I'm willing to pay $150 for it. And then we say, oh, that's subjective, right? Because it's the same hard drive, but you're willing to pay $100 and I'm willing to pay $150 for it. And that's indisputable that there is an individual relativity or variability here. But from the philosophical perspective, the case is that you, Isidore Duncan, are seeing a real hard drive that has certain real properties, and you have your values and your capacities, and it's worth $100 to you. All of those are objective relational facts. And also for me, it's a real hard drive that has certain properties. I'm aware of them, and I have my value scale and my means, and it really is the case that I'm willing to pay $150. So all of that is perfectly objectivist in the philosophical sense, the small o objectivism. And then what the philosophers then would say to follow up, would say, well, suppose Isidore, instead of a 1 terabyte hard drive, I also say, here's a 2 terabyte hard drive. How much would you be willing to pay for that? And then you say, whoa, I would be willing to pay $100 for the 1 terabyte hard drive, but I'd be willing to pay $150 for the 2 terabyte hard drive. Well, what's going on there? And it's not just some philosophically subjective weird thing that's going on in you. Instead, what you are saying is, the difference in value is objective. The 2 terabyte drive has real features that the 1 terabyte drive does not have. And the increase in value to me is tied to those objective facts about the differences between the two hard drives. That's still an objective approach to valuation theory.
So what about the behavioral economist critique of that, just having certain other things on the menu often encourages people to pay more for products that they normally wouldn't pay more for. Wouldn't that at least like push back a little bit?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Are you asking that people are not necessarily fully rational in making their value calculations?
Yeah, pretty much.
And that's what behavioral economics as an empirical matter demonstrates.
Yeah, as an empirical matter, it seems like behavioral econ shows that when there is a more expensive thing on the menu, sure, regardless of the actual cost or features of the products, people are more willing to pay for more things.
Oh, sure. Yes. So the claim is not going to be that because we have the capacity to be objective and rational, that people are always objective and rational. All of that is... It requires a commitment. It requires some cognitive skills being developed and so on. And people vary on those dimensions as well. Now, I've not studied this literature very carefully, but I have a kind of an educated layman's understanding of it. But from what you've described in that particular example, then just is to say that there are other values like status that people value, and they are willing to pay more for values like that. So you might say, you know, I don't know, lots of examples. Two sweaters that are objectively the same, but the fact that a whole bunch of people, except for one minor variation, but the fact that a lot of people in my social circle prefer this slight variation makes it more valuable to me as to say my valuing is going through some sort of social psychological connection. Yeah, we need to be open to all of that. But it still is a fact about human psychology objectively that we're trying to take into account.
Yeah, another question I have is, you describe like modernism as like a package of ideas, like, you know, liberalism, individualism, sort of a skepticism about God. How does the often religious backgrounds of prominent like libertarians square with objectivist commitments? I'm referring to big O objectivism.
Ah, yeah, well, that's an interesting question, right? So, you know, objectivism, big O objectivism, is a full philosophical system. So it says things about metaphysics, epistemology, human nature, values, politics, right, and so on. So the way you would answer that question then is to say, well, here are the, say, the top 20 things that objectivists believe. And there are lots of people who are libertarian and they would agree with 80% of it, but then have some disagreements, say, with some of the metaphysics or not. And then it just becomes a kind of a standard philosophical debate about, in the case you mentioned, about the existence of God or not. So you will have lots of people who will say, oh, I think that human beings are rational, that we live in the natural world. The natural world is cause and effect, that we should be able to work out social relations in a win-win fashion. And that means some sort of liberalism and market economy and so on. And then ask the question, well, what undergirds the natural order, including human nature? Do we need to appeal to a God as a hypothesis to explain all of that? Or do we think the natural world has kind of internal resources to generate causal order all by itself? And then that just becomes a, you know, kind of a standard debate. So what I would say, though, is in terms of forming alliances, right, because I know there's, you know, sometimes positive relationships and sometimes nasty relationships between various strands of libertarianism and various objectivists and certain strands of libertarianism as well, is that you know, the issue of religion or not is an important one. And I think it's consequential over the course of generations, but religion is another philosophical belief system at a very high level of abstraction. And there are lots of substrands of religion. So for example, you know, if I'm an objectivist or I'm a libertarian and I'm raising the question of religion, my first question would be, well, what kind of religion are you talking about? Are you talking about religion that says God is a benevolent creator of the universe and God made the world with certain scientific laws and he endowed human beings with senses and a big brain and a rational capacity, and what he wants us to do is use our brains to understand the world scientifically and to deal with each other reasonably? Okay, so that's one kind of religion. And you know, whether that's true or not is an issue, but that sort of approach to religion is, you know, less incompatible with objectivism than libertarianism than other kinds of religion. So we might say, well, what does religion mean to you? And I might say, well, what religion means to me is that human beings are disgusting, sinful creatures who all deserve to burn in hell. And my understanding of God is of this very angry, just being who's watching every move you make. So you better stay in line. And the vast majority of people are going to burn in hell, and I like that. So if that's what your religion means, then again, that's a metaphysical argument we can have. Is that conception of religion true or not? But that kind of religion is much more incompatible with any sort of libertarian or objectivism. So it's another rich set of issues to explore.
I guess what I'm trying to ask about that is the package of beliefs associated with modernism.
Yes.
Seem to be compatible with a type of religion almost more so than a lot of the atheism of postmodernists. And I'm not saying that because I am not an, I am an atheist. I'm just saying, like, why do you think that is if these are a complete package?
Yeah. Well, in one sense, the argument is then going to be, if you mean by modernism, taking the natural world seriously, studying it by means of your senses and reason, and then developing logical arguments, to the extent that you are playing that game philosophically, then yes, you are right. A belief in the existence of a God of a certain sort is more compatible with that modernist project. And so all of the big debates about natural theology going on in the 1600s and 1700s is exactly what you are describing. And then it becomes partly a historical issue. By the time we get to the end of the 1700s, pretty much all of the smart people are reaching the conclusion the arguments for the existence of God don't work, and so we should become agnostic and atheist. That's a historical point, but then every individual still needs to think for himself whether that's true, right, or not. Now, the other half of your question, remind me again the tail end of what you just said.
Yeah, I was basically wondering. So it seems like the logical endpoint
of the postmodernists. Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's the other part. And then I think there's a whole other set of issues that arise because atheism is largely an empty position, right? All atheism is saying is that theism is not true. But what is true then becomes an open philosophical and scientific issue. And the full range of non-theistic philosophies and non-theistic sciences are what has to be engaged. And so what we then get is postmodernism is going to be a position that says we look at the world without God in it. And then ultimately, we think that implies that knowledge is not possible, positive human relations are not possible, values are not followed, everything is meaningless, empty, and a thoroughgoing negativity. So that certainly is a possibility that can come out of atheism. But at the same time, there are lots of optimistic and naturalistic and pro-science atheisms that are possible. So it just then becomes a debate. So for example, you know, Ayn Rand is an atheist. Karl Marx is an atheist. So they both agree that they are going to look at the world without a religious lens. But then the debates are still going to be wide open about whether Ayn Rand or Karl Marx has the better positive account of the way the world goes. So be it like an example, you know, suppose I said you are an agremlinist. Right. So, you know, you were raised in a culture that believed in gremlins, and then you think about it and you say, you know, I don't think gremlins actually exist, and you become an agremlinist. Well, what follows from that? Well, nothing follows from that. Everything follows from that. So the full range of debate still needs to be worked out.
Okay, interesting. My next question kind of wants to go more into the chronological aspects of your book. You trace a lot of postmodern problems to Kant rejecting reason. Why, I guess?
Why Kant?
Yeah, why not Hume?
Yeah, or why not Hume? Well, yeah, Hume certainly is a natural contender. I'm not going to appeal to authority there, but when you read contemporary historians of philosophy, it's not that controversial that Kant is the most important philosopher of the last 2.25 centuries now. So any number of historians of philosophy will say that we're largely still working in a Kantian framework and working out the details and all of the variations and so on. I think that's largely true. But then why that is true is the important question, and why not Hume? So then we get into some controversial things. The first one is, well, what does Kant mean? And then we have softer and harder interpretations of Kant. There are some interpretations of Kant, and I'm going to call these the softer interpretations, that see him as a pro-reason philosopher, a pro-enlightenment philosopher who believes in universal values and so on. And then there is the harsher or harder interpretation of Kant that I and other people amount to, that Kant is the beginnings of a counter-enlightenment, that he's fundamentally subverting reason, and then a long, slow slide into postmodernism eventually. So here, what I would say is that the Copernican Revolution, and this is Kant's metaphor that he uses. So this is in the preface to the Critique of Pure Reason. which I think is something that every educated person should grapple with right at some point, even though it's a challenging read. What Kant is arguing explicitly, and this will take us to Hume, just so give me a minute here, is that philosophy up until his time has proceeded on the assumption of objectivity as the goal for philosophers to strive for. And by objectivity, he means that we have our minds or we have our consciousness, but there is an objective reality out there. And the goal of philosophy is for our minds to grasp the way the world works. And maybe there's a God, maybe they're not, maybe it's a natural world, maybe it's not, maybe it's finite, maybe it's infinite, maybe it's deterministic, maybe it's not, right, and so on. But the idea is that truth is about grasping objective truths about the way reality really is out there. And what Kant is arguing, and this is the Copernican metaphor, is that we need to shift from seeing the earth at the center to seeing the sun at the center. And that's a dramatic intellectual shift. So that then rather than seeing the source of truth being out there objectively in the world, to seeing the source of truth as in here subjectively. So in that philosophical sense, what Kant is doing is saying we have to abandon entirely objectivity as what philosophy is about. It's impossible. And so we are subjective in a very deep way. We create our own reality. Now, why he wants to do that is that he is at the end part of the 1700s surveying what has happened in philosophy, not only over the course of its own history, but especially in the last, say, two centuries since the beginnings of modern philosophy. And modern philosophy has developed various schools that have been arguing with each other. And what Kant is arguing is saying that by the time we get to my generation, we can see that all of those schools have ended in defeat. They had a certain hypothesis about how objective knowledge was going to work. It's going to be empiricist, or it's going to be rationalist, or whatever it's going to be. But all of those projects have failed. And so that then, from Kant's perspective, is to say, we cannot claim to know the way the world works. We've given reason a shot. We've given it a try. We've tried all of these versions. They all end in failure. And so what Kant is doing is a generalization on all of those failures. What this shows is that objectivity is impossible as a goal for philosophy, and we need to retreat to subjectivity. Now, why I give pride of place to Kant rather than Hume, and I don't want to say that there isn't a good argument that can be made for Hume, is that Kant argues on principle, whereas Hume argues in a more scattered fashion. So what Hume does is to say, well, if we are going to say we know certain things, we know ourselves, right? We know perceptual objects, we know cause and effect, et cetera, et cetera. If we're going to claim to know that, then we have to use a certain process. And so he will take that particular process with its objective, its object, knowing cause and effect, or knowing yourself, or whatever it is, and subject that individual process to various skeptical arguments. And then he will say, well, then we can't know for sure that I'm perceiving an object correctly, or that this category maps onto the way objects really are categorized in the world, or that cause and effect really is a feature of reality and not just some subjective imposition on that. So he kind of goes through the list in an iterated fashion and then just leaves it at that. What Kant is doing is saying, yeah, all of those arguments from Hume about skepticism, those are correct. But also all of the arguments about skepticism that we get from Berkeley, those are also correct. And the ones from Cartesian skepticism and so forth, they're also correct. And he offers a generalization and an in-principle argument that says objectivity is impossible. It's not just that it happens to be impossible in all of these particular cases, but in principle, our minds cannot map onto reality. So that's why I think he's more important.
Do you think he was acting in good faith?
That's a very interesting question. Because I know, right, there are people who see him as a kind of a hero of all things good, who made nonetheless mistakes and was the product of his times in various ways. And at the other end of the spectrum, people who will argue he was the most evil, right, or not. So here, this in part in terms depends on what you take Kant to be. So the first thing would be to say, if you think that Kant is saying that reason is impotent to know reality, and if you think in the ethics that Kant is saying that you should be a person of ironclad duty and be willing to sacrifice your happiness to duty, no matter what, if you take that as your Kant, then the second question is going to be, can someone reach those conclusions honestly, or must they reach those conclusions dishonestly? And my view on that is an agnostic position, because I think it requires knowing someone better as an individual than I know Kant as an individual. I do think anybody is playing with fire on the ethical issues to the extent that they go down the road of setting aside happiness and individual flourishing as the goal of life. Anybody who wants to say that you should do your duty even if you are miserable and it makes you miserable, I find that very hard to wrap my mind psychologically around a benevolent interpretation of that person. It's because from my other readings in history and the people whom I have known well as individuals, the people who go down that road, to my judgment, always have been people who are at least immoral, shading into evil in their personal psychologies. So if you imagine right now what it would mean for me to say to you, Isidore Duncan, Isidore, your happiness does not matter. What your dreams are and what you want in your life do not matter. Here's a list of duties that you have to follow no matter what. I can't imagine I myself as a benevolent person looking at you as a young man with your whole life ahead of you, saying that for anything more than at least low-grade sadistic motives. So I do think at the same time on epistemological issues, any intelligent person who says, my mind is impotent to know reality, your mind is impotent to know reality, is at the very least playing with fire. Now, the only reason I have some modified skepticism here is that I'm willing to say smart people can argue themselves into bizarre conclusions, and Kant was a smart person, so maybe that was happened. And the other element of my agnosticism is that as intelligent and genius as people can be, and Kant was highly intelligent and a genius, it's almost impossible for everybody to think their way out of everything that they were raised in. And Kant was raised in an intellectual and a moral context. He was raised as a pietist, which was kind of a strict fundamentalism in Christianity. And I think in his case, and this is partly a psychological point, not a philosophical point, it did get deeply into him as a youth. And no matter how brilliant he was as a philosopher, he wasn't able to think out of all of those elements of it.
Yeah, I guess it leads into the question of how charitable should we be with the ideas associated with Kant and deconstruction?
With associating Kant with deconstruction?
Or just Kant, like the ideas of Kant relating to reason or deconstruction or both.
Yeah. Well, I think if you're using deconstruction as a term of art from the Derrida generation, then we're talking 1960s. And I do think that between Kant's Critique of Pure Reason in 1780s to the 1960s, obviously that's 180 years. And there are some intellectual steps. And I don't think that Kant saw all of the implications of his Copernican revolution. And on some other elements of reason, he was still trying to maintain certain levels of universality and a certain respect for logic and so on. So associating Kant with deconstruction, you still need to say that if you make this big step that Kant made and you then make these additional six steps, then you will end up in deconstruction. And I think that's a logical philosophical development that can be made. And I make it in my book, and I'm open to arguing right about that. Whether Kant himself saw all six of those steps being made, that's an open question. I think the answer there is that he did not. Right? It took someone like Schopenhauer in the next generation to take the next step, and then someone like Nietzsche, and then someone like Heidegger, and then someone like Derrida. That's the generation. And all of those are highly brilliant individuals who are working out the territory. So the association is there logically, but that's not to say that it was there psychologically in the mind of Immanuel Kant.
Yeah, Camille Paglia argues that the postmodernists are a bunch of careerists. Is that a fair interpretation? I'm trying to get at like
I think it's an overstatement. I think it's true that there are lots of people in the academic world, in intellectual circles more broadly, who are pretenders, who are careerists. They're pretty smart, but they recognize that they're not super smart, and so they can be attracted to belief systems or ideologies that allow them to appear sophisticated and groovy and to maintain a career. So, we now are in a position to poke fun at the postmodernists by, just stringing together phrases that use all of the catchphrases to make something that doesn't mean anything, but we're hoaxing and having fun with them. But prior to getting to that point, there is a whole generation of people who learn just to do that in order to get tenure and a cushy job. But I don't think that ever explains why an intellectual movement that lends itself to that comes to prominence. So even if it can be used for gobbledygook careerist person, that always is a parasitical move. And the question is, what enabled that movement with parasitical potential to become so prominent? And parasitical second-rate people can never do that. That always takes first-rate people to develop the arguments, to create the intellectual space, and the institutional prominence that the hangers-on can then piggyback upon. So there, I think, we do have to go back to, say, Foucault and Derrida and Richard Rorty. They were not careerists. These were brilliant guys, and however wrong I think they were on pretty much everything, they were genuine. They really argued themselves into their postmodernism, but then they opened up some space for all of the second raters and third raters.
Excellent. I have one last question for you, and I want to thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure for me.
For like an erudite explanation of a lot of things that I've been thinking about recently. So you speak of the influence of Rousseau on the French Revolution in your book. Don't political movements nominally pay homage to popular people regardless of the cause? And to what extent is this like a unique movement?
Sorry, the Rousseau-French Revolution connection?
Yeah.
Well, just think by analogy. So John Locke and the American Revolution. So the American founders are not merely paying homage to John Locke because he's a popular person. Rather, he's a popular person because intellectually and activistly brilliant people like the founders recognize something important in Locke. They become true believers and they want to put it into practice. And the same thing you might say about Karl Marx and the Russian Revolution. It's not just that Marx was famous and Lenin, Stalin, and Trotsky and the others are paying homage to him, but they have some other agenda at work. Instead, they are true believers and they put it into practice. I would make a similar point with the Iranian Revolution, the Theocratic Revolution, and it's paying homage to Sayyid Qutb, right? For example, a prominent politicized theologian of Islamism. So I think it goes that way. I think the same thing is absolutely true of the French revolutionary. So Robespierre, Saint-Just, and so on, Marat, they could have paid homage to Montesquieu, who was also a famous person, or Lafayette, or Voltaire. But they did not like those guys. Instead, they liked Rousseau. And then we have to say, well, why Rousseau? And it's because Rousseau versus Voltaire, Rousseau versus Lafayette, Rousseau versus Condorcet, Montesquieu, and so forth. He has a philosophical and political package that is much more communalistic and much more authoritarian, and they genuinely believed it, and they lived it. I mean, it's a telling anecdote that Robespierre carried around Rousseau's social contract with him all of the time, right, in his book, and in moments of reflection, he would be reading it and meditating upon it. And so people do that. It's like, you know, people who carry the Bible around, or carry the Quran around, or who carry Mao's little red book around. They are true believers, and it's more than just paying homage because the person independently is famous.
I guess the thing that I'm like a little bit noticing more recently is the amount of political theater that's associated. Like, you know how Kamala Harris the other day had an interview where she said when she was like one, she said freedom at like a march, obviously plagiarized too. Don't you think to some degree there is that appeal of trying to look the part of being a disciple, regardless of whether or not like the fidelity to these ideas are actually practiced?
Yeah, let me just take the general point about political theater. And I'll say politics is always theatrical, as in addition to being substantial. And typically the kind of theatrics is driven by the more substantial things. So, you know, if we are about monarchy and hierarchy, then a big part of the theater is the king wears robes that are purple, and only the king gets to wear purple, and he gets to wear the big crown, and he always stands on a podium elevated above the rest. So all of that is theater, and it's legitimately integrated with and expressive of the underlying ideas. Or in liberal democracies, you know, the fact that the president of the United States always wears a business suit, that is a part of political theater, which is to say, we are a democratic republic. We are not a monarchy. We are not an aristocracy. We are not a military dictatorship. So even though the president is the commander in chief, he's never going to wear a military uniform, and he's never going to wear an aristocratic sash, right? Or have a sword strapped onto the side of his belt and so on. So the business suit is political theater expressing that as well. So I have no problem with theater as part of politics. And politics is partly symbolic. And so and we want it to be symbolic. We want to know what things stand for, and for those to be expressed in our political rituals as well. So I think, though, it's going to be disquieting, though, to think about what postmodernism implies for political theater. And there, the epistemology and the knowledge theory becomes more important, because, you know, one of the postmodern themes is that everything is masks, kind of surface level theater in this particular case, or certain surface level manifestations that are always a cover for something that's darker and more nasty and adversarial and oppressive. And then what we want to do is just kind of always rip off the masks to see the nastiness that's going on underneath. So if that's your substantial understanding of way politics works, then you should expect that then postmodern types of theater are going to be nastier and more cynical as well. So maybe your disquiet just is about the direction this generation's political theater is going.